You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin scientists are running experiments to better understand how the coronavirus functions. They're using animal models and research and other contagious diseases to try to make a breakthrough in this global effort to prevent COVID-19. Peter Hafman is a scientist at UW-Madison. He works with influenza and Ebola, among other diseases. He talked with WPR host Keely Boltina about studying the coronavirus and what researchers are doing under the microscope here in Wisconsin.
What do we know about mutation and this new coronavirus?
Right now, there's not a lot of mutations occurring that now have distinguished a certain strain of coronavirus from the original strain. So there's not a lot of mutation going on that we know for sure is changing transmissibility or pathogenicity of the virus.
When it comes to technology of developing a vaccine, then how are we using what we know about influenza to help us with the new coronavirus?
So our group in particular has come up with a technique to make influenza virus artificially. We're using that technique, which is called reverse genetics, to kind of modify the flu backbone. And we are inserting a coronavirus protein, the spike protein, which our immune system recognizes, into that flu backbone. So then we'll have a replication, single replication competent influenza virus modified to express the coronavirus protein. And that way we can make a vaccine that will hopefully protect people from both influenza virus and this new coronavirus.
Is it possible that we might not actually be able to develop a vaccine against the virus that causes COVID-19?
We will. The thing to remember is that these first vaccines are going to come out, you know, hopefully by the end of this year, early of next year, most likely not going to be the best vaccines. We're kind of using technologies we've had in place for other vaccines, and we're kind of implementing with this coronavirus vaccine. And when I say they're not the best, it's going to be a vaccine that you're going to have to get a prime immunization and then a boost immunization, and maybe even a third immunization to be completely protective. So we kind of want to modify these vaccines down the road so that they only require one vaccination, and that will help reduce the amount of vaccines we need to make for the world.
Peter Hafman is a research associate professor at UW-Madison. We're talking about research happening here in Wisconsin as labs rush to understand the new coronavirus and figure out how to fight it. This is the Ideas Network. Peter, what have we found out about animal transmission and the new coronavirus?
We were hearing stories several months ago about humans transmitting the virus to cats, and that's kind of something that we became interested in with our research, and it showed that once a cat was infected, it easily transmitted the virus to naive cats. And the cats in our study were healthy, and they never, besides having coronavirus, they were healthy, and they never showed any signs of illness. So there is definitely the possibility of some domestic animals like cats, and now we're hearing dogs getting infected with this virus. So they could serve as a minor reservoir for this virus or intermediate host for this virus. And that's something we should kind of keep an eye on.
What have you found out about hamsters?
We developed a hamster model for infection. And this was mainly for using for vaccine and antiviral or countermeasure research. We need an animal model to test these vaccines and antiviral drugs. So we developed a hamster model, and we are aiming for an animal model that really recapitulated what was going on in humans. And the golden Syrian hamsters that we used had very high virus replication in their lungs and only in the lungs, just like was happening in humans. And we see a lot of damage to the lungs because of infection, and we also see pneumonia in these lungs. So it's a great model to kind of look at vaccine development and antiviral development because they really mimic the infections we see in humans.
We've heard a lot about antibodies. Can you talk some about plasma therapy? What is that?
Yeah, that was part of our hamster study, too, and there's actually a study going on here at UW it's a very old technique that people have used, that they ask people who have recovered from infection to donate blood. And then the cell parts of the blood is centrifuged out, leaving the plasma that's left. And inside that plasma are antibodies. And a portion of those antibodies are specific to the coronavirus, and they're actually called neutralizing antibodies. So these antibodies in this plasma from healthy people that have recovered from the virus can actually bind to the surface of the virus and don't let the virus get into your body and then protect you from infection.
What do we need to know next to figure out if that works when it comes to the virus that causes COVID-19?
So there are clinical studies going on, healthy people donating their plasma. In the lab, we can tell that the plasma from these people have really good antibodies in it that neutralize the virus. So now it just will need a couple months for clinical testing to see if this actually can be transferred from one person to another person, the plasma and the protection antibodies that are in that plasma. In the lab, we've done this with hamsters. We infected hamsters, let them recover from infection, and then took their plasma and transferred that to naive hamsters, infected them. And they were fairly well protected from the virus.
We've seen conspiracy theories, some fear about where and how this disease started. What do you make of the public's response and understanding of this virus right now?
That's a good question. Before we got into coronavirus research, our main research is actually with Ebola virus. We spent a good portion of 2 years in Sierra Leone and West Africa during that outbreak. And we hear the same thing, too, with Ebola virus, that, you know, it's something that's a lab that came out of a lab that came out of a government. And now we actually heard this in the United States from people, and it's discouraging. It might be the fact that people don't know people that have been infected or have been negatively affected by an infection. So we just hope that there's enough education out there for people to believe that this is not a conspiracy and that it should be taken serious. And I think by the numbers that we see here in the United States of the number of infections and records we're seeing in certain states for hospitalizations and deaths, that there really needs to be a push for public education on this virus.
Peter, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And that was researcher Peter Hoffman talking with WPR host Keely Baltina there. They were discussing research here in Wisconsin on the virus that causes COVID-19 and how likely it is that scientists can develop an effective vaccine and soon. Coming up, Keely talks with a journalist about disinformation. Last week, Facebook and Twitter said they had removed accounts linked to Russian state actors who tried to spread false stories about racial justice, the Democratic presidential campaign of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and President Trump's policies. We look at the spread of disinformation that is false and deliberately does harm to a person. That conversation is in just a minute. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. On a Friday, it is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Local officials in Wisconsin are on the front lines of debunking conspiracy theories related to COVID-19. False information gains traction on social media. Then city council members and health department leaders have the burden of convincing people that the rumors aren't true. Howard Hardy is reporting on this. He's a journalist based in Madison who's a fellow at First Draft. That's a Google News Lab project to fight misinformation and disinformation online. It's also in collaboration with Wisconsin Watch. Howard is working to detect and report on disinformation online, and he's talked about his findings with WPR host Keely Baltina.
The false conspiracies you're writing about are rooted in contact tracing. Remind us what that is.
Yeah, contact tracing identifies and informs people who have been in contact with someone who has tested positive for COVID-19.
Yeah, people just don't seem to trust contact tracing. Where's the concern coming from?
Suspicion and mistrust of contact tracers kind of gained traction early on in the pandemic. You know, in the middle of March, you could see some kind of goofy ideas surrounding contact tracing kind of germinate and gain traction, where a lot of people were associating it with some sort of like Big Brother style surveillance state.
And that brings us to an Appleton City Council meeting. Local leaders there, they took wrong or unsubstantiated concerns that were swirling, especially on social media, and they started talking about them. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they got in this position where they felt like they had to address these rumors on social media head on. A big post that seemed to be really influential and directed a lot of residents toward the Appleton City Council appeared on the Facebook page Wisconsinites Against Excessive Quarantine. It was calling on people to oppose this funding that was being considered by the Appleton City Council. They were considering accepting up to $1.2 million in state reimbursement for contact tracing efforts. And this post warned that some really bad stuff was going to happen at the city council meeting, and that surveillance cameras had, in fact, already been set up all around the city. So it really seemed like it was stirring up a lot of fear and mistrust of contact tracers in general. And so the council felt like they had to address those rumors directly, which they did during their June 17th meeting.
How did they do that?
They prompted city staff members to address some of the specific rumors that they had been hearing from residents. They kind of got bombarded with emails and messages from people who lived in Appleton and people who weren't from there as well. And so they asked city staffers whether, you know, the city had any plans to forcibly remove anyone from their homes, or if they had plans to build an isolation center in the city of Appleton. And they also posed this question of whether or not cameras were being installed for monitoring people as they self-isolated or quarantined in their homes. And the intent there was just to provide a forum for the city staffers to kind of shoot these rumors down and address them directly.
What do you hear from local leaders about this, about them being questioned about things like putting up cameras everywhere?
Well, one of the main interviews in my story was with Katie Van Zeeland, who is an older person on the city council, and she was really pretty frustrated with the situation because she felt like she was being put in this position where she had to address these rumors that were kind of impossible to disprove. She felt like the burden of proof was being placed on the city council, and she just, you know, recounted this really frustrating experience of like not knowing how to prove something isn't true.
Howard Hardy is a journalist who's written an investigative piece for Wisconsin Watch. We're talking about local officials needing to debunk conspiracy theories amid COVID-19 as leaders try to get their arms around this in the pandemic and protect communities. This is the Ideas Network. How much does this distrust when it comes to contact tracing lay into, or is just kind of one piece of a greater challenge that communities are seeming to distrust government?
I would say that it's part and parcel of that greater trend of just, questioning science and being skeptical of government officials, including local officials. We've seen a lot of mistrust directed at public health departments since the COVID-19 pandemic began.
So I see this issue of the contact tracers fitting into that broader pattern of being skeptical of our local leaders and science-backed protocols.
What are you finding about people who hesitate to give these contact tracers names of friends or family they've been in contact with?
Well, I've heard from our local health department here, Department of Public Health, Madison, Dane County, that they're encountering a lot of skepticism from young people who feel like they've gotten in trouble when they are contacted by a contact tracer. They feel like if they reveal who they've been near recently, that they're going to get their friends in trouble, or there'll be some consequences for participating in gatherings, when really the contact tracers are trying to keep their own personal judgments entirely out of it, and they just really want to track the spread of COVID-19 in our community.
And yet you also heard that some contact tracers are not having problems, that people are really cooperating with them.
Yeah, I did also hear from a contact tracer who said everybody has been really cooperative and understanding of the protocol, and haven't really questioned the purpose of it, because at this point, I think a lot of people are familiar with the term and what contact tracers are all about. Whereas, a few months ago, I don't think hardly anybody knew what a contact tracer was, even though they do this for other communicable diseases as well. So in some cases, I think residents have been really understanding and cooperative.
Wisconsin's attorney general has warned that scammers could try to take advantage of people. I mean, that's a real issue. What won't legitimate contact tracers do? What won't they ask us?
Yeah, they won't ask for your money. They won't ask for your social security number or bank or credit card information. And they won't identify the person who contracted COVID-19 by name. They'll always call by phone. You're not going to hear from them via text message or email. And they're going to identify themselves by their first and last name and the health department that they work for.
This issue is bigger than Wisconsin. And yet we're really putting this on local officials, and they're trying to balance dispelling things that are untrue that worry community members with also not wanting to promote those rumors. How are they trying to figure that out?
Yeah, it really seems like they're between a rock and a hard place, because I feel like a lot of our local officials are having to answer for decisions that are being made on the federal and state levels. This funding that became so controversial in Appleton is actually CARES Act funding. So we see state and federal level funding trickling down to local communities, and then the local officials are really bearing the brunt of the misinformation. They're the ones that have to answer to their citizens directly. And in many cases, especially in a small community like Appleton, community members probably see their council members on the street or may even know where they live. So there's really no hiding from residents. So I really feel like they're kind of in this pressure zone.
Part of your work is to figure out misinformation and correct it. And I just have to wonder, I mean, is there anything that regular people can do to help stop the rumors and the conspiracy theories that harm our work to slow the spread of this new coronavirus? What do we do?
Since I started doing this social media monitoring work, I've heard from a lot of members of the public who are just like, hey, how do we recognize this stuff online? How do we avoid spreading misinformation ourselves? And there are a couple of handy little tricks that you can employ. Just avoid sharing something that comes from a source that you're not familiar with. Say you see a post on social media that has some sensational headline that evokes a really strong emotional response in you. Before sharing that information, take a moment to assess the source. It's always really helpful to just do a little research. It can be as simple as copy-pasting the name of the publication into Google and seeing what it says. There are a number of fact-check and debunk-style websites that are helpful resources as well. And the most important thing is just to kind of check your emotions and take a moment to assess where the information is coming from before you share it.
Howard, thank you for helping us understand your reporting more.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was Howard Hardy talking with WPR's Keely Boltina. Howard is a fellow at First Draft, which is a partnership with Wisconsin Watch. You can find a link to the story at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we talk about a viral illness that is very rare in Wisconsin, but it caused one death last week in Chippewa County. We learn about the dangers of Eastern equine encephalitis. Phone lines are open. What questions do you have about illnesses spread by mosquitoes and ticks? What do you want to know about how viruses are transmitted between animals and people? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll talk about encephalitis, maybe hear from you right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're learning about Eastern equine encephalitis here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is an extremely rare but serious and often fatal infection that causes inflammation of the brain. That's the encephalitis part. It's spread by the bite of an infected mosquito. And 1 week ago, state health officials confirmed that a woman in her 60s in Chippewa County died after contracting a case of Eastern equine encephalitis, or Triple E. What do you want to know about its risk and transmission? Do you have horses? Have you vaccinated them against this mosquito-borne disease? It's 800-642-1234. Kristen Bernard is a professor of veterinary biology in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Her expertise is in zoonotic viruses. That's the germs transmitted between animals and people. She investigates mosquito-borne and tick-borne viruses. Kristen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So the woman in Chippewa County was the first human to die from Eastern equine encephalitis this year here in Wisconsin, second to contract it. Can you tell us about how this affects humans?
Yes, it's a very serious disease, as you mentioned, and it's transmitted by mosquitoes, a very particular mosquito that's in that area of Wisconsin. And the virus, some people don't show any clinical signs when they, or any symptoms at all, but those people that get the disease actually can have very severe infection of their brain. And then, as you mentioned, it's often fatal. About a third of the people die that actually get the brain infection. And then those people that do survive often have long-term problems.
How does this get into mosquitoes in the first place?
Yeah, great question. It's transmitted in a cycle, and that cycle is between mosquitoes and birds, and wild birds. And the mosquito feeds on an infected bird and picks up the virus. Then it replicates undergoes all of its life cycle in that mosquito. That takes a little bit of time, but then it's able to then transmit it to another bird through its bite.
Does the mosquito also transmit it? Can it spread it to other things than humans? I mean, horses, of course, are in this as well.
Yes, so it definitely can. There are different types of mosquitoes. So the mosquito that really cycles the virus very well likes to feed on birds most. But then we have some mosquitoes that will feed on both birds and mammals. And those are the ones that we worry about the most. And they can infect any mammal that they feed on. But the only ones we see disease on, as far as mammals go, really are horses and people.
And horses have an injection for this, I understand, that there is.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the horses have, we can use vaccines that are approved for horses. And it's what we call a core vaccine. It's a vaccine that every horse owner should use. And we ask them to use it in the spring before the mosquito season every year. So it's not just a one-time vaccine. You have to give it every year. And in areas like in Florida, where we have mosquitoes all the time, they'll give it at least two times a year and sometimes even more.
Oh, so these boosters can come more frequently if the horses are in an area where the infection is a higher risk.
Yes, and where the mosquitoes are feeding all year. So fortunately in Wisconsin, we do have some cold weather that kills off our mosquitoes. So it's dependent on where the mosquito can, how frequently they can bite and if they bite all year long or not.
So I understand the Gulf Coast is particularly at risk, Gulf Coast states where those mosquitoes fester much longer in the year, the East Coast as well. How is this getting to Wisconsin?
Yeah, so we have a focus here in Wisconsin as well. So yes, you're absolutely right. Those states are most affected. But we have a focus up here in the upper Midwest, including Michigan has a focus of virus and activity. And in Wisconsin, we have a focus of virus activity. And really, it's dependent on that mosquito vector that we talked about earlier. If you have the habitat for that mosquito vector and it's present in that habitat, then you're at risk for eastern equine encephalitis.
And so if you have full-blown Triple E, even if you survive it with this inflammation of the brain, can you fully recover? There is no vaccine for humans.
There's no vaccine for humans except for, actually, there is an investigational one that researchers use, but there is none that are for the public. And it's very difficult to recover if you do get that encephalitis form. People have really long-term difficulties with seizures and memory loss and sometimes in coordination. So it is a problem, and there's no treatment for either the long-term problems nor for the actual active inflammation.
I don't understand. If there is a safe and effective vaccine for horses, why can't we make one for people?
That's a million-dollar question when it comes to vaccines. And really, it comes into how we definitely could. You know, we have the scientific knowledge to be able to do it. And it comes to the point of whether or not the pharmaceutical companies can make it worthwhile, I suppose we can say, for them to actually develop this vaccine. Then we have questions on who would receive it. And every vaccine, there are some side effects that can happen. So should we immunize everyone in the country for a very rare disease? Should we immunize everyone that's in Wisconsin in the northwest corner? You know, so there starts to come into some very difficult questions, and sometimes it's monetary questions as well. You know, yes, we could make this available, but it would cost us so much for the very few people that would need it that it's not worth the while.
Does it have the same devastating effect in horses?
Yes, it's very deadly for horses as well. The mortality rate is actually even higher. It's about 90%. If a horse gets the brain infection, and about 90% of those horses will die.
We're talking with Kristen Bernard, who is a professor of veterinary virology at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She's an expert on zoonotic viruses, which are transmitted between animals and people. We're talking about eastern equine encephalitis. Do you know about this? What about horses? Do you have them? Have you vaccinated them against this disease? What about illnesses from ticks and mosquitoes? What do you want to know about transmission? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's take a call now. Rita is joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Rita.
Good morning. What a beautiful day in Wisconsin. I just recently befriended some friends in my apartment complex, and the gentleman had contracted West Nile virus through a mosquito 3 years ago and is in the recovery process. And there was so few instances of it, they traced it, part of it, to birds in Minnesota. So, yeah, I'll hang up and if she wants to talk about that as well.
Rita, thanks. Can you, Kristen, give us an update on West Nile?
Yeah, so West Nile is, as probably everybody has heard about, is also transmitted between birds and mosquitoes, different mosquito. So we find West Nile throughout the state of Wisconsin. At least you are at risk for West Nile virus throughout the state of Wisconsin because it's a completely different mosquito vector. But it is transmitted between mosquitoes and birds, and so it cycles in that in wherever the birds and mosquitoes live. And West Nile right now is not a high activity in the United States in general. We can have years where it'll be very, very high. Typically in Wisconsin, we'll have about 10 encephalitic cases per year, and that's the brain infection.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How do you treat West Nile?
So again, just like with Triple E, there are no specific treatments. So it's just going to be supportive care. If it's a brain infection, the person's going to be in intensive care and get fluids and sometimes even are put on ventilators.
Let's bring in Amanda now in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Amanda.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead with your question.
Okay. I wanted to know if the encephalitis crosses the embryo of the eggs that we eat.
Crossing the eggs of what we eat, Kristen.
Crossing the eggs of what we eat. No. So your chicken eggs is what you're wondering about?
Yeah.
And that's actually a really good question because it does infect birds. So you might wonder if it could. And no, it does not. So that's one good thing. It does not cross into the chicken eggs or duck eggs or any eggs like that you might be eating.
Amanda, thank you for that question. You know, are mosquitoes good vectors? Are they effective at really transmitting disease and virus?
Yes. So it depends on which mosquito, like I've kind of been talking about this morning. Some mosquitoes will transmit a virus, and there's a very specific relationship. So as I mentioned, West Nile will use Culex species mosquitoes and some Aedes, but primarily Culex species mosquitoes. And that Triple E actually uses a completely different genus, which is interesting to us biologists, and it uses Culicida. So they are very specific, and those mosquitoes that can be infected by these viruses are unfortunately very good vectors.
We're learning about Eastern equine encephalitis. Triple E, a very rare viral illness transmitted to people and horses through a mosquito bite. UW-Madison virologist Kristen Bernard is our guide. What do you want to learn about symptoms, diagnosis, treatment? How do you protect yourself against mosquito bites and ticks? Still time to talk with your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Kristen Bernard from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, where she studies mosquito and tick-borne illnesses. A death was confirmed a week ago in Wisconsin from Eastern equine encephalitis, which is typically found in the eastern U.S., as we've been talking about, and in the deep south along the Gulf Coast. As of August 25th, three confirmed cases of Triple E virus disease had been reported to the CDC this year. Those cases are from Massachusetts. Let's bring in Kurt now in Marshfield. Hi, Kurt.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, I just wanted to say I had a donkey that I had die of Eastern encephalitis about 3 years ago. It was pretty kind of a nasty progression. You know, it was the first day we actually thought it was maybe a little ill. It was kind of lethargic. And by the second day, it was basically paralyzed. You could tell it was, you know, aware, and we were, you know, trying to give it, you know, the supportive care, watering it, giving it, you know, taking care of it. But, you know, basically by the third day, we knew that there was no way that we had consulted with a couple of vets, and they're like, wow, there's really nothing that we can do for it. And if it's in that bad a shape, we actually ended up having to put that donkey down. So, you know, it was, I've got a farm, so we deal with a lot of different, you know, veterinarian care and stuff. And so probably of all the illnesses that I've come across, and it's a pretty devastating illness when it gets into an animal like that.
Kurt, thank you for describing your situation. Kristen, this sounded very progressive in Kurt's donkey.
Yes, and that's very typical. I'm sorry, Kurt, to hear about your donkey. That's devastating to have to see, and is really so hard when there's nothing that we can do as veterinarians or as owners to help the animal, except for, in this case, having to humanely euthanize the animal. And donkeys, I should mention, when I say horses, I'm amiss at not saying all equids. So
okay.
The donkeys
I was
would
about
be
to
included
ask that.
In there.
Yeah.
And it's very sad to see, and it's such a difficult thing. And so all the equids should be vaccinated yearly. That thank you for telling us that story.
Yeah, Kurt, appreciate the story. Bringing in now Jim in River Falls with a question. Hi, Jim, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. So I got a couple more generalized question to start with is, with climate change and global warming, thoughts about spread of some of these diseases. I know, like, some of the vector ticks for Rocky Mountain spotted fever are moving farther east and north, and it seems like tick-borne diseases like Babesia, and my dog just became ill with that over the past weekend, and that seems to be a pretty common issue, as well as Lyme disease. And then I've also got friends that deal with cervids and epizootic hemorrhagic disease with the culicoid midges. It has been a problem in some places in Minnesota now. I don't know about Wisconsin, but and then as far as specifics, I'm just wondering, is there anything for the epizootic hemorrhagic disease that people can do either for prevention or, you know, if it's in a, yeah, obviously getting away from the midges or indoors, but that's not real practical. But
yeah,
any thoughts on dealing with that?
Yeah, Jim,
yeah.
Thanks. And he started there with the changing climate and what our weather patterns have to do with the activity level of these vectors.
Yeah, thanks. I'll start with that one and then see if I can also talk about epizootic hemorrhagic disease virus. And climate change is very important with the vectors. As you know, changing in the rainfall patterns, that can change where the habitat for the mosquitoes to breed. Also, the increasing temperature, actually that affects not just the mosquitoes and ticks, but also the ability of the virus to replicate inside those mosquitoes and ticks. With the warmer temperature, it actually replicates better. So we actually can see more viral activity in warmer summers, for example. We'll have a spike in West Nile virus due to a warmer summer with lots of mosquito vectors. So absolutely climate change, and it's also changing it's expanding where we find our different mosquito species, which then can bring in new pathogens. So you're absolutely right there. I could also comment on epizootic hemorrhagic disease virus. Not very many people know about that
virus.
Yeah,
you're going to have to give us a primer.
Yeah, so I tell my veterinary students about this virus. And it's a virus that affects deer. White-tailed deer primarily is very deadly for white-tailed deer. We can also sometimes even see it in cattle. So we'll see some spillover. When there's lots of viral activity, we'll see it in cattle. And we've seen it in Wisconsin in cattle. It's been now, 5 years or so where we've had it in cattle in Wisconsin. There are no vaccines for epizootic hemorrhagic disease virus. And so the only real practice, and it's not very practical, is trying to control the culicoides, which is not a mosquito, but is another type of insect that can transmit, that does transmit this virus. So that would be difficult to control those midges in the environment, but that would be really
there
the
are
only
no
thing
chemical
I could
sprays or any type of sprays that help.
Yeah, I mean, there probably are some larvicides,
okay,
I would say, so things that kill the larvae. That's not my expertise,
sure,
though,
sure.
So I don't know about, in particular for midges. There definitely are for mosquitoes, and maybe both larvicides would work on both, but we'd need to talk to an entomologist about that.
We're talking with Kristen Bernard, who is an expert on zoonotic viruses at UW-Madison, currently working on mosquito-borne and tick-borne viruses. She worked with the SARS virus after it first emerged in 2003, and she's taking your questions. Let's go on to Kevin now, joining us from Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good morning. My question is this. How common is it that these zoonotics are able to pass through the maternal placental barriers?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it really is variable depending on what pathogen we're talking about. So when we, you might be thinking about Zika virus, and that is a virus that does transmit to through the placenta very easily, damages the placenta as well as then getting into the fetus. And not really all that common with very many of the viruses that are truly zoonotic. We do have other problems with some human viruses, such as cytomegalovirus and some other herpes viruses, but really not a huge problem with the zoonotic viruses that I can think of, except for something like Zika. And that's definitely a problem.
And, you know, as we look at the coronavirus that we're fighting right now, what can you say about that transmission between animals and people?
Yeah, so probably a lot of you have heard about this virus actually did originally come from animals. And the most evidence that we have is pointing to live animal markets in China where it first emerged. And that we call that a species jump. So it jumped from these animals into humans. And it's not, at this point in time, it's great circulation is happening between people and animals. We have seen a few instances of cats being infected from their owners, some tigers in the Bronx Zoo in New York, and some mink farms in the Netherlands. So we have seen some going back from people to animals, but we have not seen a lot of transmission between animals and people now that this is just so worldwide pandemic happening. It's really just circulating in people right now.
Right. So it is much more kind of closing that loop, and it's not, you don't see those openings between transmission from animals to people.
Not currently. Now, you know, long term, maybe we will see a little bit more once we get a vaccine that's effective for people. Hopefully not, but it is always possible and something that as scientists we'll be looking for.
Kristen, thank you for joining us.
Yes, you're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Kristen Bernard is a professor of veterinary virology at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, where she is an expert on zoonotic viruses, which are transmitted between animals and people, and she's working on mosquito-borne and tick-borne viruses. Just ahead, we look at the recent attention around bail funds and how the cash bail system works. Stay with us for that. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.